Early in President Eisenhower's first term in office, he stated that every gun that is made, every warship that is launched, every rocket fired signifies in the state of the United Nations Special Assembly meeting. He said this: on the behalf of the President, I pledge the United States to a major effort in support of the development. My country dedicates itself to this enterprise because our children, yours and ours, must not live in a world of brutal inequality. He went on to say, we are a part of a large community in which wealth is an obligation, resources are a trust, and joint action is a necessity. A short time later, Secretary Kissinger, in addressing the World Food Conference, proposed a worthy goal. He said that within a decade, not a child will go to bed hungry, and he urged joint action to regain control of our shared destiny. If we do not act boldly, disaster will result from a failure of will. And then you remember what I said in the introduction tonight. You know, that we've lost ground, and it's getting worse, and we as a country are paying less than most of the other countries relative to what we're making. Now, I learned in my lifetime what it is to be cold and what it is to be hungry, and I want to give you a first-hand knowledge about that so that you will not feel sorry for me as a prisoner of war, but that you will be moved to compassion for the millions today so afflicted. My hope is that this compassion will extend to working towards a national commitment to do something about world hunger. If I called for a show of hands here tonight of who of you been hungry, most of you would probably raise your hand, because some of you at 9:30 in the morning are already hungry. But that is not the kind of hunger I am talking about. The kind of hunger that I refer to is the kind of hunger that slows down your body after weeks and months of inadequate food. The kind of hunger that causes your thoughts and your conversation to be wholly devoted to the subject of food so that all you can think of is food. Fantastic meals by the truly hungry are described ad nauseum. In fact, in one of the prison camps in which I was interred, the conversation about food became so disturbing and so distressing that we agreed to forbid any conversation about food. Prisoners would barter expensive watches and other items for little, very, very little bread. People who you thought were your friends and honorable would steal food from you. With continued limits on rations, we did not care whether school kept or not. We really did not give a damn. We would just as soon sit there and lie there and sleep. And that's what we're seeing. That's when people are really chronically hungry. That's what's going on. And I want you to understand that. But and mine was different, though. You see, mine was a temporary situation. At least I hoped it was. We had some hope for better days. For too many people, most tragically, children, mothers, there is no hope. The most tragic hunger is evident in children with shriveled limbs, swollen bodies, and shrunken minds. In the grief of mothers of starving children, and in the persons gone blind from malnutrition. When extended starvation, lassitude, and confusion sets in so that the victims are unaware of their plight, and the body's defense mechanisms diminish. Disease kills most famine victims before they have a time to starve to death. And I want you to know that. For the most part, hunger is invisible. The victims are shielded from our view. They suffer for years in quiet obscurity, mind and body functioning at a slow pace. One of the most remarkable books on this subject is by Carolina Maria de Jesus. Its book is called Child of the Dark, and is required reading for all of you. It's in a paperback. It's a diary of a Brazilian slum dweller who had only 2 years of formal schooling, and more copies of her book were sold than any other Brazilian book in history. Is it? You got copies here, though, haven't you?
Would you use that title again?
It's Child of the Dark. By Carolina Maria de Jesus. In it you will learn the sordid consequence of hunger, alcoholism, prostitution, violence, and murder. And that is probably why Carolina Maria de Jesus said, the worst thing in the world is to go hungry. It should be mandatory reading for all who are well fed, and that includes everybody here. Okay? And we tend to regard this world food hunger is way out there, but we got to bring it here. And I have some other words, except in closing, I'll tell you what I mean by this. In view of the diminished concern evidenced by our government, our action should be directed at changing this attitude at the national and international level, but at the same time, do all we can to promote capable volunteers to assist the hungry in decentralized self-help programs to help the hungry help themselves. And some of you probably are familiar with these. Maybe you've done it, and that's what we want to hear. Now you're going to say something, Mary.
Well, Leo asked me just to say what we're doing at Holden. I think of two things, well, three things. I think the way we eat says something about the way we feel about food, that food is to be celebrated. We do that once a week on Sunday. The rest of the time, we eat with a little less. We eat with less desserts. We eat lower on the protein scale because it takes 10 pounds of grain protein to produce a pound of beef protein. Yes. Besides our eating habits, we're also collecting money for the Tractor for Zimbabwe. I think that's something appropriate to do because we know that it will directly affect the hunger situation in southern Zimbabwe, where 200 or 300 people can be supported by the farm run by the Lutheran Church there. I think in orientation, I at least give you a brief description of what we're doing, and that's to raise $20,000 for a tractor for Zimbabwe for the Lutheran brothers and sisters. We also have a group at Holden that's active in Bread for the World. How many of you belong to Bread for the World? Could I see your hands?
No, I'm not.
Bread for the World. Okay, I'll in 2 minutes tell you what Bread for the World is about. We are very charitable as Christians. The Christian churches last year raised $200 million for food aid for oppressed people throughout the world. In one vote of Congress, they took out $200 million worth of aid, absolutely wiped it out. We're very charitable with giving the check, as Leo said tonight, but we're not very active in making our Christian citizenship heard. Bread for the World is not a direct relief organization. That's Lutheran World Relief, CARE, CROP, some of these other, World Vision, 4 or 5 that I think of. Bread for the World is a lobbying organization. I never liked the word lobbyists until I realized that Bread for the World was a lobbying organization, and I like it when they lobby for things that I think are important. It's a way of having Christians throughout the United States. It's an ecumenical group. It's a way of having them write letters to their Congress people and say, I really feel very strongly about this issue. I want you to pay attention to it. This is how I feel about it. Because you're on the Appropriations Committee or because you're on working with the World Bank or whatever you're doing, would you please pay attention? I am one of your constituents, and I think that's a very appropriate way to have us express how we feel. Bread for the World has been very successful. 2 or 3 years ago, they had the Right to Food resolution, which had a lot of far-flung implications. 240,000 letters went to Capitol Hill, the most letters ever on one issue, and it was passed unanimously through Congress. Since then, Bread for the World has had 4 or 5 very successful lobbying efforts, a grain reserve bill, last year a bill that simply made sure that any development aid we gave to nations had associated with it the fact that they had, that it was a self-help program, that we just didn't give them food without having them do something for their own development, because hunger is not an easy problem at all. It's naive to say if we stop eating desserts at Holden, hungry people are going to be fed. Bread for the World is exciting to me. The head of it is Arthur Simon, Missouri Lutheran pastor. His brother Paul Simon is a congressperson from Illinois. I think there are more Lutheran pastors that belong to Bread for the World than any other group. We are having Bread for the World members are at Thanksgiving time, are having a letter campaign. This year it's for African food relief. If you think that we give too much money to poor nations, we are 17th in a list of 18 giving nations according to our gross national product. Leo mentioned that tonight. We give 0.2% of our gross national product for relief, and most of that goes as a food, as a weapon. We give it to people who are politically expedient or who we think we want in our camp. And so one of the things that Bread for the World is asking Christian citizens to do is to write letters at Thanksgiving time about the fact that at least half of the food aid should go to countries that really need it, to people that are really hungry, not just our allies or like South Korea where we want to keep them in our camp, that sort of thing. If you think we already give too much aid, Somebody stated recently that we give seven, it would take $17 billion a year to feed, house, clothe, educate, and give medical assistance to the two-thirds of our world that needs it. And people say, $17 billion, that's just extraordinary. That's what the world spends every 2 weeks on arming itself. And I just don't see how those two things are compatible. We cannot feed people and keep up the arms race. So I think the Zimbabwe Tractor, the Bread for the World group that's active here, and the way we eat are three things that hold in this group.
Do you want to say about, there's another thing, and we got to get you talking, is that but the investment you make is very important. And where you put your money, and Lutheran World Action, is you have to look at the overhead of these various issues. A lot of the agencies that are asking you for money for this may have up to, they have slick paper advertisements in big magazines that really get to you. And they probably spend 60% on administrative costs. One of the lowest administrative costs is Lutheran World Action.
97% goes to actual aid. 3% for overhead.
Lutheran World Relief. Lutheran World Relief. And so when you write the check, pick them very carefully. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, quickly, because a lot of you were not in the Bible study this morning. We were looking in Isaiah chapter 30, where Isaiah warns the people that they're turning to horses, and human armaments of those days was non-productive because the enemy's horses would outrun our horses. The point being that we find our salvation in repentance and in rest. And the whole emphasis of Isaiah, which we're looking at this week in the 9 o'clock Bible studies, is what does it mean to be the people of God as a compassionate people? The text that we're going to study tomorrow deals specifically with the issues. So for biblical foundation of what we're talking about, I'd like to urge you to come to the Bible study. But I have to say this, my own emphasis in biblical scholarship came because of finally having the world hunger issue presented to me personally. I mean, I grew up in a very pious Lutheran home, and you know, we were all good people that cared about hungry people. But when I was 19 years old, I was on a concert tour around the world. We sang in India, and I watched a man die of starvation right in front of my face. That changed my whole life, because suddenly it was not a problem over there. But it was, I saw a man die of starvation. And I saw the hungry children. And I saw the glaring contrast of the Taj Mahal and all the beggars that are right outside. And I saw that I couldn't do anything about it. And it broke my heart to come back to the United States. And I've been suffering culture shock ever since. And it's because of that that I was driven to the prophets. And the more I studied the Old Testament prophets, the more I realized that they were saying all along what we're experiencing now. And to get back to the biblical truth inspires us to recognize that we must begin with repentance. And beginning in repentance, then we have a basis for compassion.
Leo, there was a fine old character in the comic strip that we no longer have. His name was Pogo. And Pogo lived in the swamp. And Pogo was wont to say, "We have met the enemy, and it is us." Now you've touched on a couple of things here, but you haven't really clarified them. I can't challenge you about the need. The need exists, but you have intimated that somehow the two, the problem of, let's say, for want of a better word, defense or military posture, whatever, however you want to say it, I don't care. And the help that you have suggested is needed are somehow related. Now, what is your idea about the relation of these, or how should they be apportioned? Is there a threat? I don't think you can argue for one against the other, or weigh one against the other, without examining the issue. Does there exist a threat? What does one do about that? You've talked about the existence of a need. What about the existence of the other? and how do you relate the two, and how do you apportion a share?
All right. My concern, I guess, is manifold, and it's the same one as Eisenhower expressed, that I don't think we need more than, between us and Russia, more than a 30-ton equivalent of TNT in nuclear weaponry for every man, woman, and child in the world, and still putting money into it to build more. I think that money could be utilized other ways and more efficiently. I have respect for the fact that there is evil in the world that is out to destroy us. I can tell you some hair-raising stories about that. One cannot read One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and come to any other conclusion. And that was allowed in Russia at one time, and Stalin was discredited. But 2 years ago, Azanov, who is head of their defense, talked in February to all of the military, the leaders of the military in Russia, and he said that, and he got two big ovations, both times when he mentioned the greatness of Stalin. Well, that worries me. And so they're out to get us, but I think it's one of re-examining our investment. And I made a proposition in the military back at a research and development symposium a long time ago. And I said that we should have a Department of Peace and War, and that there is a segment, because there's no agency in the world that is better equipped and knows more about communication, health delivery systems, transportation, communication, than our Department of Defense, nor has invested more in it, and food and nutrition. They really have. And in many places on the earth, when they have trouble, when you have hurricanes, who cleans up the mess? It's the military. In many places, they are acts of mercy. So I said, and this is many years ago now, I said, which tells you where I'm coming from, I hope, that you should have then two uniforms, and these people are just workers of mercy. They're part of the peace. That was before the Peace Corps. That actually, without concern whether they are enemies or friends, that where people are in need, we make this expertise available to them. Had we done that, we would be in far better shape today. And so I guess, I hope that partially answers you what my concerns are. It's the allotment of...
Yeah, I don't understand what you mean by far better shape, and what the evidence for that would be. You know?
Well,
that's an assertion.
Well, I say we'd be in better shape from the standpoint that those people that we had helped without expecting anything in return would not look on us today as much of the world does.
I have a problem with a couple of things, Leo. One is that I think, to be perfectly honest, we have to agree that in our present governmental system, these needs are not interchangeable. If we do not spend a dollar for military weapon, does not automatically make that dollar available for other kinds of expenditures. These expenditures are determined by our representatives in Congress. So I was very taken with this. emphasis on lobbying, because I really think that we do have a representative government, and that's the handle that we have on this. We want to see things change. That's the other approach. The other thing is that there, in the last few years, has been kind of an interesting switch. Some of you may know that we have worked with Ethiopia, or we did for quite a while, and the Soviets were working very strongly with Somalia. We built bases and airfields and did rehabilitation of some of the villages. They did the same thing in Somalia. Today, Somalia welcomes our presence and not the Soviets, and Ethiopia welcomes the Soviets and not us. I don't think we could buy friendship in any case.
Not the way we did it.
I just don't think it works. We better do it out of love for Christ rather than trying to better our own lives.
That to me is the interesting question I think that should be raised tonight is, do we approach the hunger situation, I think, as one example of economic injustice in the world, as Christians, or do we approach it primarily as citizens of the United States? And I guess I've wrestled with that for a long time and raised that issue in our church about a year and a half ago, and by a vote of about two people got voted down on that issue, and that was a severe disappointment to me personally, that people were afraid as Christians to stand up and say, I'm a Christian first and whatever else second, whatever the choice might be. And they were, I think, doing it basically, I thought, maybe out of misunderstanding, which I think led to fear. Basically, I was trying to raise the issue of peace as an answer, I think, to some of the economic injustices, and raise the possibility of the Lutheran Church looking at establishing what I would call a peace academy, which is not a new idea. It's an idea that's been around for many, many years. And that seemed to be a threat to a lot of people. Again, getting at your question of the Department of Defense, or as it used to be called, it probably should be called the Department of War. They were looking at that as, some real threat to our way of life as we presently see it. And it's interesting to see what's happened in the last year. It's such a dramatic turnabout in terms of where we're now going to spend our money and try and rectify the budget situation. And it's ironic to me to see us do it in the way we're doing it, and to spend billions and billions on building a bomb that's not going to destroy buildings but kill people, first of all. To me, that's abhorrent. Not that I want to kill people, destroy the buildings too, but there's a choice that's been made there. And one go on and on with these examples, and you ask the question about where does that money go? It's not a matter of a trade-off. Well, I think that if you stop spending money on defense, that it would automatically go for some other purpose. At least the option's there. And when you build that bomb and lay it away, it takes away that option. It really doesn't do us any good. And for the first time, we're beginning to build weapons that we're not using anymore. And we haven't done that for a long time. Most of the weapons that we've built in this country, we've used. I'm not making any judgment as whether that's right or wrong. But for the first time, we're beginning to see weapons being put in stockpiles, ones that have never been used. And that's new, and we don't really know what to do with that, and we're having a problem of how to handle those too. I guess the other concern the issue I've raised is that probably hunger is going to be with us as long as we're alive, as long as my children are alive, and as long as their children are alive. It's been with us ever since, I think, mankind came on earth, and probably will be, but that should not deter us, I think, in any way from dealing with the problem. But I think we need to recognize that and emphasize that too. I guess where does that leave us? I'll go back to my original question of, do we want to be Christians first? I think we have to raise that and answer that question first.
William Stringfellow has a quote that we use often in Holiness. I want to see my country biblically. I don't want to see my Bible Americanly. And that, to me, puts it in perspective, Bob, as to what you said. You know, what about this threat? If we see everything through Secretary Haig's glasses of, you know, the communists are coming, I don't think that's looking scripturally at our responsibility. And as far as that kind of threat, I want to put a plug in for a session Tom Witt's going to do this week on a Yoder paper. John Hart Yoder has a paper, What If? You know, what if somebody comes into my house and is going to kill my wife or murder my baby? That's what everybody usually jumps to immediately. And I haven't read the Yoder paper, but I think that would be a carry through from this talking tonight to just hear the options that are available. What if you are threatened? You know, is there only one thing to do, drop a neutron bomb on or kill him in some way? Or is there another way through a Christian perspective to react?
Also that there's a lot of things flying around here, and maybe some people are a little confused. But your question about threat, and also you've met the enemy and they are us, all of that, and a few other things that we've been saying is that Solzhenitsyn, who wrote One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, said also recently, a couple years ago, that he's convinced that evil isn't so much one country and another country, it's in one country's good and one country's evil. It's just that all of us are good and evil. It's not a separation of countries. And maybe that's back to what you said earlier about repentance. Isaiah.
You are probably referring, probably his best thesis on this was his Harvard graduation address a few years ago. It's really worth reading. And this is the issue he addresses, and I think that's also required reading.
Yeah, there's a couple hands.
All right, there's a hand there and then a hand here.
Am I first? Thank
you. You're first.
Thank you. Having been, and still am, a member of the Friends Church, the Quakers, as you friends would know them, we believe our premise works on the idea of taking away the occasion of war, which would involve our hunger and all the social injustices, that we are to tackle these problems and try to diminish the occasion of war. And it seems to me it would answer some of our questions here, just as you're doing. We still are, and I'm troubled personally, how can I tackle, me as a Christian, the problem of this escalating, accumulating stockpile of destructive war weapons, and how can I do it? I do write. Recently, I wrote to the President of the United States. I have often said I tread where angels fear to tread. But I do write to my congressman. But that isn't enough. I feel that we should become involved in speaking out against the nuclear escalation and tackle it some way.
More and more people are becoming very concerned about this. I was recently at MIT and Harvard with a group there looking at this. I was really involved in the Princeton conferences on prevention of nuclear war there many years ago now, and more people are becoming very concerned about this. And people in very high places who before this was not such a burning issue with them have suddenly become very, very concerned about this. There was a recent group, there has formed a recent group, maybe you belong to it, on the physicians for the prevention of nuclear war. They had a meeting at Early House not long ago. near Washington, D.C. And there were a lot of people, physicians from a lot of places. I think that Brezhnev's personal physician was there. President Reagan's physician was not there. I don't know why. I'm not making a judgment on it. But these people are concerned about the effects of nuclear weapons. I was in a meeting with the president of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy, who was very concerned about this. I sent him the material that he was unaware of from the Princeton conferences. So this is becoming a very critical issue in many places today where it wasn't before, some people thinking that it's becoming more imminent, not whether or not, but when. Yes, now you.
Yeah, it seems to me, and I think I'm following what both of you have been saying, is that we are so apt to be swept along with this new mandate and feel that there's no hope at all for influencing Congress on the peace move. Now, you mentioned Representative Paul Simon. Paul Simon is very much concerned about the peace movement as well as Bread for the World. Our own congressman had a public meeting in our town, Mike Lowry, a few weeks ago, directly on the peace issue. He used the physicians concerned about nuclear war as an example and was urging the constituents to develop a citizen movement modeled on that and the kind of thing that goes that Bread for the World is doing. Senator Mark Hatfield, Oregon, is a strong voice. So there are voices in Congress, and I don't think we should all of a sudden say the party in power has got Congress in its pocket and lay down and play dead. There are responsible voices in Congress urging us to build up a groundswell. I suppose the thing that shocked me the most about what Mike Lowry was saying the other night, he says we continue to prepare for war as though we were going to fight World War II over again, but with nuclear weapons. He says World War III will last 15 minutes to a half hour, and all we'll have is destruction. He says, and nobody will recognize the fact that if World War III starts, the nuclear buttons will be pushed on both sides, in a half hour it's all over, and the world's a mess. And he just kept drumming that, and I think he's got a point, because we cannot seem to envision what World War III would be. And yet that's the only possibility if a nation wants to win the war, is to push the nuclear button.
Yeah, it's a question of whether they win or not.
And nobody wins. Nobody does. But that's the attempt.
Yeah, there's debate on limited nuclear, but I don't know if this would be helpful to discuss that. But you make some very good points. I was going to say, in passing, Paul Simon sat where I'm sitting here one day here at Holden.
Paul speaks very highly of Mike. That's how I had to tie the two together.
Yeah. And his brother is the one you mentioned who wrote
the
book. It's a very good book, I think. Who else had a hand up? I didn't see it from
you. Yes. Thank you, Mary. Just a couple of things I'd like to submit here. Having worked with people who have been dealing with this quite intensely for the last couple of years at least, one thing I'd like to remind everybody here is that we have taken one quantum leap closer to this eventuality in our entire approach to a first strike policy. And I don't know, we certainly don't have time to go into this here, but it's something I've done quite a bit of work on, and would be happy to discuss with anybody if they wanted to. I'm not an expert, but I know quite a bit about it. The other thing is that we're about to make another quantum leap, and that is in a launch-on warning system about to be deployed in Europe, actually over the Soviet country, to protect our Pershing missiles, where the Pershings have been decided to be put in. They're too close to the Soviet missiles. The satellite would go in and make a decision without any human intervention whatsoever. It would make a decision within 3 minutes to fire the Pershings if the computer felt that there had been a lock. And some extraordinarily dangerous system. This is literally the same computer system that screws up your phone bill. It's not exotic, perfect system. And it's a very frightening thing. But also in a hopeful sense, I'm responding a little bit to what you were saying about writing your congressman and writing your senator and this type of thing. I've done all that in the last couple of years. It's been quite a fascinating process. And I've done some personal lobbying with senators and whatnot. The one thing that I have come to believe out of the chaos that moves history is that we can only be certain that our inaction will not have a result. Our action could result in any number of ways. We've lived in a period of history that's seen major changes in our understanding of race and our understanding of sex and our attitude toward the environment. These have been movements. The Vietnam War response shifted the whole country's posture for years in shifting back, but it was a big thing and happened very shortly in a relatively short period of history. So there is great hope in action here. You know, and right now in Europe, there are governments, you know, that are in big trouble because the people don't want them to deploy certain nuclear weapons. They're going out in the streets in hundreds of thousands. We don't hear about it much. But Schmidt and all these people are backing off because of public opinion. So it, you know, I think there's great hope in this period as well.
Yes. The man behind Alan and Alan.
It seems we got a little off the subject. We were kind of talking about world hunger, and then we got to the nuclear problem. I really feel one of the ways to help solve world hunger is for us to learn from the people in the third and fourth world, and consequently, so they could have more respect in themselves. If they could teach us how they're able, with such meager resources in many cases, to do as much as they do, and if they can realize that themselves, then I think we'd be taking a giant step forward. I think we're too arrogant as a country to try to think that we've solved all these problems. We've been lucky, I think, more than so intelligent. And we've been the problem in a lot of the third and fourth world by the technology that we've exported to them. And a lot of them have left their old ways that sufficed for years to run to this technology. This has been the problem. This is one of the things that Gandhi was talking about in India. That was so much the problem. Gandhi wasn't against technology, but he wanted to make sure that he lifted all the people up equally with the technology.
Al?
Leo, there have been a lot of questions raised here, and they're all difficult ones to answer. And I'm going to add another question here, and I don't know if there is an answer. But as part of this whole hunger situation, we talk about hunger and what can we do about it. And certainly we need to look at it. But how? What are we thinking about? Are we simply going in to feed people because they're starving? Or are we going, let me add this. Whenever there's a disaster, there's no question about what we should go in and help. But in the long term, let me back up again. In many of these countries, there is a potential for food production in these countries. Should we go in? Isn't the answer really to go in and help them produce food for themselves? The biggest problem, it seems to me, is political. We've had experience with this in our country with our foreign aid programs. We go into countries, provide money, provide food. We have shipped in food, and what have these countries done? The politicians in these countries decide that we can now industrialize because we're getting food. And this is documented. This isn't just hearsay. Many of these countries have abandoned agriculture because we have provided food. The records show that in some of these countries, food production has actually gone down. And there's been a quite a migration in many countries from the rural areas into the cities. This is another question. I don't know the answer, but what are we doing if we just simply provide food? When there's a disaster, no question, but to provide food, it relieves the people of the job necessity of doing it for themselves. The second point I want to raise right in this connection is that every country in the world, the national policy is low-cost food, including the United States. That's one of the top priorities in any government, is low-cost food.
We don't have a food policy in this country.
Yes, we do.
No, we don't.
Well, it's if it isn't a direct policy, it's one by default, really.
Okay, but it's not a policy that you can identify on paper. There are other countries that do.
I think I could pull out the things that are being done that really act as a policy. There may not be a written policy as such, but everything that is done in this country is directed at, and in the final analysis, is designed to hold, to bring about low-cost food. That's a national policy in every country. So, whenever anything is done in these foreign countries to improve food production, in most cases, it requires technology. And the production cost, the farmers, the government brings the price of the food down, and the farmers simply do not apply technology because the prices are held down to the point where they can't recover their input costs. Now, Leo, that I don't know the answer, but these are some of the things that come up, and I have read that the problem is politics and not technology.
I will address a few minutes on that. In my final statement, in the opening thing, I said that we should work towards promoting capable volunteers to assist the hungry in a decentralized self-help program to help the hungry help themselves. And this is a critical issue. And in my first-hand experience is in Kenya. One of my associates was founder of the International Laboratory of Research on Animal Disease in Kenya, near Nairobi. And he was over there 3.5 or 4 years, established an outstanding laboratory. But as I visited with him, he says, our problem in too many places is that, and I ran into a friend of mine who was over there performing surgery. And he says, our problem is we go over there and do this for them instead of teaching them how to do it. And they're going to keep doing that until we quit that. And so now I'm very pleased to say that we have a big project, as you know, at Washington State University in the Sudan. For various reasons, our government is very interested in this. But he, as one of the honchos in this, he's sensitive to this. So in the AID program there, they are trying to do it in situ. In other words, not change so much the situation there, only to make it more productive, building on their system and teaching them how to do it. And so I see a little glimmer of hope there along the lines that you were speaking.
What are we trying to teach them to do, though? That's the question. We're trying to teach them to grow more food? Is that what we're trying to do? Or are we trying to teach them to want Chevrolets or refrigerators?
No. In this case, it's very basic in Sudan.
Well, I think that's the intent, but quite often, you know. But look at what's happening. The people from the rural areas are coming to the cities, and they're trying to get refrigerators or appliances of some kind and so forth.
Yeah, in the Sudan, we are not working in the big city. We're out in the really boonies.
Leo, may I address a little bit on that?
Yes.
In Mexico, there is an attempt being made, which is very interesting to me. As you know, Mexico suffers from roughly 2/3 of the villages are without electricity of any kind. Water supplies are rudimentary and often polluted. Life expectancy is very low. It's measured in the 30s in many communities.
So many of the people are leaving these local rural communities, which are their farming communities, by and large, and moving into cities. Mexico is attempting to establish some of the electricity, some of the amenities in the remote villages. And they're using high technology to do this. They have a project called Softland, which is done jointly with the Federal Republic of Germany, which is attempting to establish a solar village, Las Barrancas, which is a small fishing village. And in that, they will have various kinds of solar technology, which will pump water, which will provide refrigeration for medication, which will provide power for the fish cannery so that they keep the fish more than just a few days. And in general, provide this remote site with a reason why people go to villages. And it seems to me that if we go anti-technology, we are going to be defeating the aspirations of the people. Now, we can't go in and tell them, we will help you raise more rice and therefore stay on the farm. We have to listen to them as to what they want. I think Mexico is making an attempt. They may be unsuccessful, but I think they're trying, and I like the direction they're going.
And it's interesting where they came from, too. That was one of the first countries that went through the so-called Green Revolution.
That's right.
And unfortunately, that didn't do them very much good. It raised a lot of grain, but it really did not raise the nutrition of those people to that extent, because they were not able to really share in that. Much of that grain did not end up in the bellies of the people of that country.
It was sold to gain foreign exchange for Mexico.
Right. You know, basically, you know, the problem you're talking about, they weren't getting paid enough to do that. The land wasn't divided equitably. And as you said, you know, there weren't the things that they wanted for their kind of lifestyle. And I think as we talk about world hunger, you know, we talked about the nuclear issue, and I think that's still germane to it. But there are other issues, too, I think, as we talk about hunger and medical care, all these kinds of things. That's not enough just to go in and show them how to grow those crops and to develop that technology. There are some other things that we need to do along with that in terms of sanitation, in terms of education. But those people are going to, I think, really come along and raise their standard of living, not necessarily maybe to ours, we probably should be lowering ours, but at least to raise their life expectancy. So it's really a life.
Yeah, this is how we are looking in Sudan, at a multidisciplinary team to look at these aspects.
Well, I just want to add to the problem that where I see myself personally as being involved in world hunger is things like, up until 2 years ago, I think it was, McDonald's got all their beef from Guatemala. I refused to eat at McDonald's, because the Guatemalan people who own the land, and yes, land reform is necessary within Guatemala with their own government, but if they turn all of their food producing acres into grazing cattle, because we Americans want a fast, quick hamburger, I think that's where I'm very involved in world hunger. Mm-hmm. Haiti, most of the land in Haiti grows sugar for Americans. Coffee in Brazil, yeah, I confess, I'm a big coffee drinker. I can't stop drinking that. But there's no trickle-down theory that's supposed to work. All if the plantation owners or the big people in those countries discover they make more money by exporting things to the United States, whether it's coffee or rubber or sugar or whatever it is, they turn that land into that particular crop. Mexico, 40% of the winter fruits and winter vegetables that we get in the United States come from Mexico. So the top two states in Mexico have been turned over to producing vegetables for the United States, and I don't know why I have to eat a tomato in January. That is not necessary, because the people there do not eat well, because the land is producing things for us. So I feel a complicit. What's the word?
Complicity.
Complicity, thank you. In a lot of world hunger problems, just because of my consumer habits, things that I think I have to have. And I have this naive vision of all the Christians in the United States stopping eating at fast food McDonald's and refusing to buy tomatoes and saying I can get along without coffee. And why it's those little first steps that get us into the mess, why isn't it possible for enough Christians to say, you know, world hunger is going to stop with me, and I'm going to stop these habits? I just think something like that is a very powerful way to protest and to say, I am concerned.
Well, look at how powerful, I hate to, but look at how powerful it would be if you found a farmer in India that was very successful with his meager resources. And then we actually would look up to this person as a teacher, you see, rather than disregarding him and trying to show him our methods, you know, with our high technology and so forth. This then, would really, I think that we'd be saying something to the other people of the world if we were to reverse this situation a little bit. I've heard very little of wanting to listen to how the Chinese possibly are able to produce so much with so little technology, or some of the people in India and so forth.
A little more is going on in there now. I can be a little encouraging there. We have a project in Kenya, and we're listening to those people that come over here to give their views on it. In fact, we're, instead of having a honcho from here over there doing it, we pick a honcho from there who's directing it. And we've had people from China now telling us about how they're doing things. So I can be a little encouraging there. Let's see now. I saw, I'll come back to you, Al. There's over there, and then up there, and then to you.
I have a basic question, which I'm bothered about with all the conversation. I don't think the average Lutheran knows hungry people in the United States in their neighborhood. They don't know sick people. They don't know destitute people. People in clothing or in prison. We've forgotten. We just talk about people there.
Yes.
We don't know our people. I'm from Albuquerque. If there's a third world war, we're one of the first places to be blown off the map, because we're the prime research for nuclear weapons. And we all know that. We even live there. But our people in our congregation don't have any sense of where the poor are in Albuquerque and the sick who belong to our church or don't belong to our church. And I remember where 60, 70 years ago, one of the very strong things of the Lutheran Church in the United States, east of the Appalachians, was that every congregation had intermission committees, active people groups in the congregation who knew the hungry, the destitute, those to be clothed and sick and in prison, and did something about it. And then when Roosevelt came along, of course we gave it up because the government did it. And we've never gotten back to it in the Lutheran Church.
We probably will be getting back to it.
I
think we need to raise that one.
But it's a very, you raise a pertinent issue, and there are already, I'm pleased to say, also actions in this regard. And I think that we're going to come back to helping ourselves where we live, and to start remembering or recalling, you know, that this is a neighbor in need, as we used to do. In this regard, I have a little traffic with the governor's office in this state, and Linda Hine will be joining our committee here tomorrow. She's an associate of mine. We're very much involved in a volunteer program in Pullman, and she was the only representative from our area to be invited by the governor's wife, along with a lot of other people from the state, to have a meeting in Olympia. Here just a few weeks ago to discuss this issue of volunteerism. And the governor came in and talked to him, and they're going to form a council now of volunteerism to really look at how you help out in your community and proper training of them. And it's, of course, very vital to us here as we look at a farm, and you'll be hearing about it. We're staying here this week as we look on Wednesday at the hospice program. And you're dead in the water if you don't have well-trained volunteers for it. So I am. I'm sort of. It may be a blessing in disguise to get to looking again to work in community for the common good.
I don't know. I think that is also much needed. volunteerism, but I see also, which disturbs me, the women who normally have done the volunteering are all in the labor force now. And it's a struggle for me too, you know, keep up with inflation, you know, should I, instead of doing my volunteerism, start getting paid for it someplace else, you know, doing something. And I really feel badly that so many of our women
I'm going to bring more men into it, and a lot of those are retiring and retiring early.
And I
wanted to bring them into it. Now, I, before you, Marilyn, there's somebody who's been holding their hand up for a long time up there, and we'll come to you. Yes.
I have just one, sort of statement and question. We've talked a lot about helping people to, increase their own capabilities and the like. And I'm wondering, of the organizations we've discussed, there's Bread for the World, which seems to be primarily a lobbying organization, not much food relief or even food teaching. And then there are other things like the Lutheran World Hunger and World Vision and the like. Are there any actual agencies that go out and teach people how to how to increase their own production rather than just handing them a sack of grain and saying, eat well for a week?
Oh, that's a World Relief.
That's what the
World Vision does too. There's a real strong emphasis on self-help and World Vision.
How about Lutheran Brotherhood Exchange?
That's volunteers that go overseas to help. There's a group called Self-Help in Iowa that provides, it shows people in different third and fourth world countries how to build their own tractors. Intermediate technology kind of thing that doesn't just hand them even a tractor, but teaches them how to build tractors and plows and things like that.
Very strong alternative energy program coming out of England too, which has such things as a one-man tractor, which consists of a little motor and a cable. You run the cable across the field, and it pulls and winds the cable up on the little motor, and the person attaches the plow to the cable. And it works.
Marilyn.
Forgive me for speaking again. Or was it you?
Yeah. Well, Marilyn is, and then we'll come to you, okay? And then we'll get to you, Alan.
In trying to make some connections between what we've said about the arms race and what we've said about our connections to world hunger and how we would personally respond to that, I think to look for institutional answers can be a mistake if that's where we put all of our energy and endeavor. I think that's important to try and work at that level, at the government level. I guess I call it a question, the fact that someone said that we have a system where the constituency influences the decisions that are made by representatives and senators. I think that we have to be serious about the power of special interest lobbying groups. I mean, if Bread for the World can have a lobbying group, so do the corporations who, Boeing and everybody else in Albuquerque and, you know, who have an interest in keeping the arms system and keeping federal dollars funneled there for the health, in quotes, of our economy. I guess that I think that we really won't get motivated to see that our connections to people outside of our own communities unless we either become volunteers, or I think that even that tends to committeeize our whole thinking about the poor and the needy. And I heard a story about a community that takes people into itself who need food and clothing and shelter. And many of the people who end up on their doorstep have knocked on the doors of churches and been referred to this one group of people who do the compassion in that town. I think that's pathetic. I think that if there's going to be a rising presence of the poor in this country, we're going to have rooms of hospitality in every Christian household that's really a Christian household. And it's when we begin to feel our connection with people that closely that I think it's a much more holistic and natural connection to then look at the political systems and a world market economy that sets us up to look at food as a commodity. So it's also interrelated that and confusing. But
yeah.
Connections have to be made between all of those spheres, I think.
We have specialists today for feet and hearts and kidneys. Fortunately, there are no PhDs given for compassion. And I hope there never will be, because it's the responsibility for all of us. But I recall when they were writing the Constitution for our country, things were not going well. And so Ben Franklin says, maybe we ought to open with prayer. But they didn't have any money to hire a chaplain, so they couldn't open with prayer. And that's for truth. But this is an important issue. You're next. And then it's Al, will you give way to this new person? And then,
well, as most of you know, Raymond's church is very poor and one of our smaller churches. And so we still have the very poor with us. And the way we tackle it, we're doing it lamely, of course, and not all together holistically, but as best we can. The elderly mothers or the more mature married women take some of the younger women and they teach them how to can, how to buy for their children. These people that are on welfare, they teach them how to preserve their own food, how to make gardens, how to sow their things, to bring it down practically.
Yes.
But I'm troubled. I don't meet the standard. I, as a senior citizen, would like to know better how to eat the foods that I need and yet eat less, spend less for food. I'm spending more for food than I should. So tell me how.
We got 5 minutes.
I've been responding to a lot of different things that segments of what people have been saying. Before, when you were saying the hungry will always have the problem of world hunger will always be there, and Marilyn's comment about bringing it down to the grassroots, I think a lot of, if a movement is to be successful, we're obviously going to have to get more and more people, concerned Christians, involved.